Coming up on the WUNC Politics Podcast, Holly Grange discusses her bid for governor and why she believes she's the best of the Republican candidates.
I bring a little more sensibility to the table.
Please silence all electronic devices.
You have to bring people to the table. People have to actually engage. I don't think that that's been done effectively in this situation during this budget process.
Did you ever accept campaign contributions from Lindbergh?
No, I did not.
If you had, in light of what has played out, would you have returned them?
I would have returned them or donated them to charity. It's tainted money, as far as I'm concerned.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the legislative dungeon in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along, as always. Today, a conversation with a candidate for governor, a representative in the North Carolina House from New Hanover County, and she is seeking the Republican nomination to take on Roy Cooper in the general election come November. Representative Holly Grange, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here in the dungeon.
That's what we affectionately call it. We're going to save the candidacy for a few minutes, but I want to start with the Middle East, and I want to start with kind of the urgent moment, the big topical news story of what is happening right now. Listeners obviously will note in recent days, Major General Soleimani was killed in an American drone strike. Then yesterday, Iranian military forces fired missiles at an American base in western Iraq. Just to get us started, a heavy question. From your perspective, are we at war right now?
I wouldn't say that we are at war. I think we're trying to stop a war. I think it was very prudent for us to respond to those missile attacks because, and as you know, we have a lot of Fort Bragg soldiers on their way to the Middle East. That's to stop anything further from happening. That's not to incite anything further from happening.
You mentioned Fort Bragg. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people, they might just not be aware of how central of a role in some ways North Carolina plays in much of what is happening around the world. Thousands of military members have been deployed in recent days. Friends of yours?
There are people there that I know that that are serving. My son actually just left the 82nd Airborne. But what I will say is I served at Fort Bragg in my first assignment in the Army. And even back then, Iran was a big player on the world stage as far as what our contingency plans were. And we used to say, if anything is needed anywhere in the world, call 1-800 18th Airborne Corps. And that's true. And North Carolina is on the front lines. All of our military bases are. The units at Lejeune, the units at Seymour Johnson, and the units at Fort Bragg. And I assure you, we've had a lot of special operators over in the Middle East, probably that we places we don't even know for some time.
You were educated at the U.S. Military Academy. You're a graduate of West Point. You are a career officer in
well,
the
not
Army.
Necessarily no. Full career.
Okay.
But I served on active duty for almost 9 years. I was in the third class of women at West Point, so it was back in the early days of women going there, and served active duty 9 years and then went into the reserves and left the reserves in 1997. So,
to the extent you have your finger on that pulse, how much has West Point changed for women in that time?
Well, my son actually graduated from West Point in 2012, so I have been up there quite a bit since I graduated, 30 years prior to that. But it has changed a lot. There are more women there. When I was there, my class started with 126 women, and on graduation day, we only had 62, so we lost roughly
wow.
half. More women stay in the Corps of Cadets. I will say this for all of the Corps of Cadets, they are very, very smart young men and women, and I'm not even sure I could get into West Point now if I had tried.
The thousands of troops who have left Fort Bragg very abruptly in recent days and gone to the Middle East, this is something that you have some familiarity with.
My husband was career military.
Right.
And he actually before I met him, he participated in the Grenada. He spent quite a bit of time in Delta Force at Fort Bragg. So he was always gone. Once we got married, first Gulf War took place, and he was gone almost immediately. And his time as commanding general of the Big Red One, that was during Bosnia and the Kosovo days. So he's often been in harm's way. And my son as well is a veteran of Afghanistan.
In those initial moments and days, when your husband or your son went off to a battlefield, went off to war, what are those initial moments like? What are you doing to pass the time?
Well, what I will say is that the military does a pretty good job of preparing families for those types of situations. At Fort Bragg, for instance, there is a global ready force. The 82nd Airborne usually has a brigade that is designated as a global ready force. And that unit is on standby. So they make sure that those families are prepared and those soldiers are prepared in the event that there is some reason that they deploy for any global emergency. The 82nd Airborne is a unique unit in that they do have a lot of deployments anyway. So they prepare the families. Also, when you look at that, since we've been at war since 2001, those units still are on regular rotations to harm's way.
Not to be personal, but to maybe get a little bit personal, for you in those days, are you seeking out a support network of people on whatever base you're at? Are you turning to prayer? I don't mean to be sarcastic. Are you turning to wine? Are you turning to a book? Like, what is it that gets you through that?
What
initial?
Helps you get through that is a support system of people going through the same thing you are. There's always a rear detachment command structure to help any family that needs any assistance. And there, back when I was in the military and as a military spouse, we had family support group leaders who were essentially volunteers within the unit. Now they're actually hired personnel to help each unit and help the families navigate any situations that they have. So it's really a support group of people going through the same thing you are. Not to say that church groups don't get involved. There churches get very involved when units deploy because they're affected, especially, you know, in the communities, that they exist.
What's something you learned as a soldier as well as a military mom and a military wife?
I would say that probably to be prepared for anything. And also, when you don't see an end in sight, take one day at a time.
In the next few days, you and I are sitting here on a Wednesday morning having this conversation. What are you looking for in the next few days as we see either further ramping up of this conflict or perhaps a settling down? What are you hoping for? What are you keeping an eye on?
Well, I think that any deployment of troops is really going to be as a deterrent. I really think that what I would think that the goal is to be able to sit down and actually have a discussion with Iran about, you know, what is going on. We don't need to just be reactionary, and I don't think we are being reactionary. We need to react to the attacks that have been made upon us because that would make us look weak if we did not respond to those.
Republican House Representative Holly Grange here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can follow her on Twitter at Rep. Holly Grange. You are running for governor.
I'm running for governor.
Why are you running for governor?
Because I think our state needs leadership. We don't have a leader as governor right now. It's very important that a governor represent all of the people of North Carolina, not just a political party and not just special interest groups that support that governor. And I don't feel that we have that now. I feel that our current governor has put North Carolinians in harm's way with some of his veto decisions. I think that he has been very short-sighted about a lot of the issues that have supposedly been the reasons why he vetoed the budget and all of the mini budgets that we're trying to pass to fund education and teacher salaries and such. We need a governor who's a leader. A leader will bring people together, will bring people, stakeholders together, people together to solve problems and to get things done. And that's not taking place right now.
Is Dan Forrest that person?
Holly Grange is that person, and I'll tell you why. I am that person because I have proven leadership ability. I've been a leader in the military. I've been a leader in any community that I've lived in all over the world. And I've been a leader in the legislature. I actually have a voting record. I actually have had to have bills drafted, debate them on the House floor, vote on bills, take a stand on issues, as well as bringing people to the table to solve a problem. Case in point would be the association health care plan bill that I was a primary sponsor on. And us primary sponsors brought in all of the stakeholders to make so that we could come up with a product that would work for the people of North Carolina and help close that coverage gap.
Is that your proudest policy achievement?
That is, I'm very proud of that. I'm also proud of a lot of the work that I've done for the military and for the National Guard. Every biennium, the Department of Defense has a list of issues that they want pursued, as well as the National Guard. And I've worked very hard to work with those groups to get legislation passed for our military and the National Guard. Also, I have been a proponent for a lot of bills that have become law for first responders, our firefighters, mm-hmm. our police.
Just to take a step back for a moment, I think a lot of people listening are aware of this, but we have a Democratic incumbent, Roy Cooper, who was elected in 2016, narrowly beat Pat McCrory. He's facing two Republican challenges. He'll face one Republican challenge, but there are two Republicans who are seeking the gubernatorial nomination, yourself and Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who has been a statewide official for the last 8 years or so. And you were a bit of a surprise to a lot of people jumping into this race. I'm wondering what you think are the biggest contrasts, the biggest differences between you and Lieutenant Governor Forrest.
Well, as I said, I'm a proven leader. I'm a veteran. And North Carolina, as I mentioned before, is a military state. I've served at Fort Bragg. I know about the military. And really, and I use this statistic a lot, we have nearly 800,000 veterans in North Carolina. We also, if you add in the number of active duty military and their families, that's nearly 10% of our population here. We are a military state. We have veterans in all 100 counties, veteran business owners in all 100 counties. So I bring something to the table that I identify with the needs of those people, a very large percentage of our population. As I said, I actually have a legislative record. My opponent does not have – he's never cast a vote. As the president of the Senate, there's only a vote cast if there's a tie. There's never been a tie. So I can say that I actually have a legislative record, a conservative legislative record. I'm not a career politician, and not to say that my opponent is, but he certainly comes from a political family. So when I'm asked that question, I say, well, I don't come from a political family. I come from a military family. And those are different values.
So I hear proven leadership. For a conservative voter who's going to go to the polls now in less than 2 months, what more is there? What more is there from your candidacy that you think makes you the premier choice?
Well, I think people also need to look at electability. We need to have a nominee that can beat Roy Cooper. If there is not a competitive race in the governor's race, then Roy Cooper isn't going to have to spend a lot of this money he's gone all over the country raising. He can use that to work on the legislature and can use that to work on the judicial branch. And we have some crucial races coming up in both the legislative and judicial races.
What is it about Forrest that you think makes him less electable in a general than you?
Well, I think that it's important to – It's never easy talking badly about your opponent, and I really don't want to do that. I think I bring a little more sensibility to the table, to put it nicely.
I want to ask you about the word of corruption, the question of corruption. And as we look at the other two candidates in this race, the major party candidates, there have been claims that Governor Cooper improperly used his authority to negotiate or procure this mitigation fund from Duke Energy in exchange for what was a necessary environmental permit so that the natural gas Atlantic Coast Pipeline could move forward through part of eastern North Carolina. As a reminder, that the ACP is on hold due to separate litigation. Then on the other side, there are these ties, depending on your political persuasion, probably more real or more perceived, between Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest and Greg Lindbergh. He's the Durham businessman. Lindbergh donated close to $2.5 million to groups that have supported Forrest. Lindbergh was indicted for federal bribery last spring, allegedly for trying to curry favor with the state insurance commissioner. I'm unaware of any corruption that has been attached to your name. So, I mean, if there isn't any, feel free to throw it out here now. But it seems to me like you haven't necessarily been hammering that point home.
Well, we're early in the campaign. Frankly,
not
I don't.
Not that early, though, right?
Well, I mean, we're not. We're less than 2 months out for the primary, but how many North Carolinians have even thought about the election coming up in March? When you look at the fact that we just had two congressional races that finished in September, mid-September, then the municipal races after that, and then, you know, with the holidays, I don't think people are – I think they're starting to tune in now. Of course, the diehard politicos like myself, you know, of course, I'm always engaged
you
and there are
in the
people
right.
in every community that are always engaged. But the average North Carolinian is not engaged. And getting back to the so-called corruption, yes, you know, there are issues for both of those candidates. You know, Greg Lindberg never gave a dime to anybody without wanting something in return. Apparently, you know, that's the alleged allegation against him in the bribery case. So what did Greg Lindberg want in return, getting $2.4 million?
Did you ever accept campaign contributions from Lindberg?
No, I did not.
If you had, in light of what has played out, would you have returned them?
I would have returned them or donated them to charity. It's tainted money as far as I'm concerned.
So that would be a difference between you and Forrest.
Yes,
your opponent
it
there, because he has received this money, and he has, as far as I know, as we chat here on January 8th, still has some of that in his
coffers.
Absolutely,
mm-hmm.
Has not rolled it forward. I'm going to pose a hypothetical to you. We hear a lot of criticism from Republicans about the governor, about the way he has not negotiated the budget and Medicaid, and just an unwillingness from the executive mansion to work with the legislature. Now, we've heard a very similar narrative from the executive mansion, just for context, but here's the hypothetical. You become governor, and either in 2020 or 2022, Democrats take back both chambers of the legislature. So effectively, the dynamic is flipped, and you as a Republican governor have to work with a democratically led legislature on a spending plan. How would you do that?
You have to bring people to the table. People have to actually engage. I don't think that that's been done effectively in this situation during this budget process. There has to be compromise on some things. Not everybody cannot get their way. Look at where we are now. We have a stalemate. We have nothing happening. We have teachers that haven't even gotten their step increases because of this stalemate. So at some point, people have to come together, and not everyone is going to be happy. Not everyone is going to get everything they want. But we have to look at what North Carolinians need and not just, you know, we're not going to give the other side a win, or it's my way or the highway, or, you know, we're not going to give you what you want because you're of a different political party.
Your primary opponent, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, has raised a lot of money over the years. He boasts, I think, for most strategists I talk to, a notable if not significant war chest. We are about 3 weeks before the next filing period, so we don't know what you've got in the bank, but what would you be willing to share? How have fundraising efforts been going? Where do you stand right now?
Fundraising efforts have been going rather well, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know the numbers and the figures because I have other people that do that for me, but I will say that the money that we are spending, we're spending it very wisely, and we're not wasting the money that is donated to us for our cause, and I get more and more support every day.
Have you decided to self-fund?
No, I'm not planning on self-funding, but I'm actually not even in a position to self-fund a race such as the governor's race.
Okay. How do you appeal to the independent, moderate, educated, white, soccer mom, suburbanite who most strategists tell me you can't win this state without? How do you appeal to them if you get past March 3rd?
I bring sensibility to the table. I talk about what is important to those voters. It would be security, safety, public safety, school safety, national security, because we have that military population that has to deal with that on a daily basis. Good education in our, you know, good schools. School choice is very important. Parents being able to parent their children and make sure that they're educated the way that they feel that they can be best educated.
there are a lot of policy issues we could get into. In doing research, you try to uncover certain positions and just understand where people are when you're about to sit down with them. I wasn't entirely clear in doing my research where you are on the issue of abortion, and I wanted to dovetail that into this question of, you know, suburban educated white soccer moms who you most likely need to win a statewide election. You criticized the governor for his veto of the Born Alive.
Well, I criticized him for the veto of the – my public safety criticism was the veto of the sheriff's cooperating with ICE.
Okay. Did you criticize him for the Born Alive veto, or did you not?
I voted for the veto. I voted for the bill. I don't think I publicly criticized him for that, but I think it was a horrible vote. The veto was horrific as far as I'm concerned.
And just to be clear, you said you voted for the veto. You voted for the override.
The override. The override. Well,
sure
we don't vote for vetoes.
Right. No, overrides. I know. Just make sure I had it. On the issue of abortion, in what circumstances, if any, are you okay with abortion?
Well, I'm pro-life, and I've got a personal story that I don't know if we have time to share, but I actually have a sister who's born at 23 weeks. She was less than 3 pounds when she was born. She's 38 now, so this was 38 years ago when babies didn't live when they were born that small. And my mother was in her 40s. She actually was encouraged to abort my sister because she was having an extremely difficult pregnancy, and she refused. And very shortly thereafter, within weeks, is when my sister was born, and she was viable. So that's why I'm pro-life. I would say, as far as abortion goes, very, very limited circumstances. I would think, you know, if it's to save the life of the mother, that would be one, and you know, rape and incest in some situations as well. I think that very limited exceptions.
In what situations wouldn't rape or incest be supported by you?
I think it would be a case-by-case thing. I don't think there's a black and white.
Okay. On Twitter, at Rep. Holly Grange, we're going to chat about a couple of policy things here. I spent some time with your opponent. He joined the Politics Podcast a couple of months ago, and I'll remind listeners of that, just as we reminded listeners when we interviewed him that we were going to do our best to get you in this seat, which we have done, and we're glad that you've agreed to the conversation. Lieutenant Governor Forrest and I spent some time talking about opportunity scholarships and charter schools, and I want to get into that a little bit with you. You have two sons. How are they schooled?
Well, they spent their early school years in Department of Defense schools as military children, and then went to public middle school. When my husband retired from the Army, the first job he took was in Illinois. So we lived in Illinois at the time, and my kids went to public elementary and middle school and went to a private high school.
Okay.
A Catholic school.
Okay. In terms of opportunity scholarships or charter schools, is there an ideal number of charter schools in the state? Is there an ideal percentage of the student population that ought to receive opportunity scholarships from your perspective?
Well, I would think that opportunity scholarships should be focused on people who can't afford to send their children to a school that would better their situation. I was in the position when my children went to private school to be able to pay for that. And I think if people should be able to pay for their school, their private schooling, they should not be able to get an opportunity scholarship. I don't think that's appropriate because there are limited resources. And we need to focus those resources on the success of children that don't necessarily have all of the options available to them.
If elected governor, how much of a priority would vocational education, vocational funding be for your administration?
I think that it would be great, and it would be very important. And the reason I say that is because we have businesses moving to North Carolina every day that have workforce issues because they need a trained workforce in order to fulfill the jobs in their companies. And a lot of these businesses are actually partnering with our community colleges in order to provide those programs so that they have that educated workforce and that experienced workforce. I think that's very important. I think vocational education is very important. back in my day when I was in high school, that you they, there was shop class. And there were students that, that went, left school in the afternoon to go work in a vocation. And that's long gone because everything has been, all the curricula is so regimented right now, and those opportunities don't exist anymore. But I will say that not every student is destined to have a four-year college degree. And how many of those students with four-year college degrees can't go out and find a good job, as opposed to those linemen who are in the lineman program at Cape Fear Community College, who have recruiters come from many, many states trying to steal them away from North Carolina because there's a shortage of linemen in the electricity field.
We're going to go various and sundry, relatively rapid fire here, and let the chips fall where they may.
Okay.
North Carolina's teacher pay should rank what from 1 through 50 in the United States?
We should be competitive, and you need to keep in mind when you look at teacher pay that cost of living also needs to play. We are never going to have teacher pay as high as New York and California because the cost of living there is so much higher. They need to pay those teachers so much more. I will say that we've jumped roughly 18 spaces, in teacher ranking, pay ranking since but I believe 2000
since the recession.
Since the recession
I think since
ended,
it really bottomed
right,
out.
Right, since it bottomed out, we've jumped over 18 states, and it's continuing to improve. I will say that Governor Cooper has vetoed every teacher raise that has been put forth since I've been in the legislature. But I think it's a work in progress. Frankly, I was a substitute teacher at one point in my life, and that was a very difficult job.
What subject?
It was elementary and middle, so it was a cross general subject. But I will say that after that experience, I determined that you really can't pay teachers enough. But being a teacher is also a calling. Like the military, you can't pay soldiers enough either.
One race that will be on the ballot here in 2020 that is not getting enough attention, a North Carolina 2020 race.
Well, we have – I would say I don't think the judicial races are getting the attention that they deserve, especially, when you look at the fact that the Supreme Court is partisan now and it's skewed quite a bit. The judicial races, I think, are going to be the most important.
And just to be clear, you're talking about the state Supreme Court.
State Supreme Court, not U.S. Supreme Court.
The U.S. Supreme Court also partisan
too.
to a degree,
but I don't have a say. That's not going to be on our ballot.
Correct. roughly, if you can approximate or give a precise number, how many times have you jumped out of a plane?
Oh, I can give you the exact number.
Please.
I've jumped out of a plane 29 times.
I've jumped out of a plane none, just I guess for comparison's sake. Is there a particular jump that stands out?
Well, I've actually had two jump accidents.
You
go through five jumps in airborne school, and my seventh jump, I was at Fort Bragg, and you have to go through jump refresher if you've gone a period of time without jumping. So I had to go through jump refresher where you do two jumps. The sixth jump was a piece of cake. The seventh jump, I had a mid-altitude entanglement with a reservist that was doing training at Fort Bragg and fell 100 feet. My parachute collapsed, fell 100 feet into about a mud puddle that was about 4 feet deep, which saved me.
I was going to say thank goodness for
mud. I had a scratch on my nose. That was it. My father, of course, was in the 82nd and was Special Forces. And I called him. He was assigned to Korea or Philippines at the time. And I said, Daddy, this is what happened. He said, well, whatever you do, go out and jump as soon as you can, or you're not going to ever want to jump again. So I did. My 29th jump, my last one at Fort Bragg before I went off to the Engineer Advanced Course, I broke my ankle. And it was a night jump. It was one of those jumps where the wind was such that you just came straight down. So my ankle took the brunt of the weight I was carrying, mm-hmm. my rucksack and everything. And I thought I just sprained it, rolled my parachute up, went to the assembly area. And I said, I think I sprained my ankle or something. And everyone was whining and moaning. I got into this ambulance. And it turned out I was the only person with a broken bone. Everyone else sprained their ankle, and I was the one who broke theirs.
Exhilarating, terrifying, somehow peaceful. How would you describe
it? It's can be scary when you're actually exiting the plane, because in military parachuting with a static line, you just really – it's like lemmings. You just follow the person in front of you out the door.
I don't know.
But I will say once the parachute opens, it's a very peaceful feeling. It's very quiet. And then, of course, landing is the hard part because you don't know what's going to face you there on the ground, what you're going to land on or how hard the ground is going to be or which way the wind is going that, you know, could potentially be dragged by the parachute.
Would you support a service requirement in the United States?
I think everybody should serve. Maybe not necessarily the military, but serve in some capacity. I think that's buy-in. And I think everybody should serve. I've always believed in that.
I didn't realize this until recently. You passed the bar in Illinois, practiced law for a time in the state of Illinois. What is something you miss about being a lawyer?
I actually became a lawyer late in life, and I decided to do it because I'd always wanted to do it. At West Point, we had to take a class in law, and I did very well in it. And then while I was in the military and while I was a military spouse, I was never anywhere 3 years in order to go to law school. So when my husband retired, I took advantage of that opportunity. I did mainly estate planning and estate administration. What I liked about practicing law was being able to meet people and help people. And I know that sounds very idealistic, but, you know, essentially that's what lawyers do. I did not practice long enough in Illinois to transfer my license to North Carolina, which is why I don't practice law here. I would have had to take the bar exam again. And I promised myself when I took the bar exam, the one time I have taken it, that I would never take it again.
I've taken it zero times.
Yes.
And I will rest my head forever with having taken it zero times. Holly Grange is in her third term in the North Carolina House of Representatives. She is seeking the Republican nomination for governor. That primary, if you're not aware, is now less than 2 months away, March 3rd. Representative Grange, thanks for the conversation.
Oh, great being here. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, as always, for listening. You can subscribe to the WUNC podcast if you do not already. Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play. Stay up to date with whatever is happening in North Carolina politics throughout the week at our website, WUNC.org. Special thanks to Jishnu Nair, who helped with the research of this podcast, a Syracuse University student who spent some time in our dungeon here at the legislature this week. Thanks, as always, for listening. For Holly Grange, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again soon.